Blog Talk Radio.
See that? Masonic effects? It's just absolutely amazing that we can do this every time we make these connections. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. We have a good show today. It's but I'm kind of excited. I think I get a bit manicky this time of year. We've just passed the autumnal equinox, haven't we? So we've all sampled that moment when we were figuratively in balance. Let's not get too carried away, you know, that for the likes of Freemasons, that doesn't last. We'll go on and find some other questions to ask and probe. And it's good. That's a clever little segue, if I do say so myself, to the show today. Commentary refers to inspiration. So you can just imagine. We have been thinking, you know, about the importance of raising questions and accountability, and how certain groups can become transfixed with all of the complications that we can think of. Being intelligent people, that's what we do. We can come up with all kinds of imaginative ways of critiquing and criticizing because we may not always be discriminant about why we're asking the questions or the point of our questions. We've mentioned this before on the program, if you I assign you to find the flaws in the Mona Lisa, or what form of architecture would we declare the Hagia Sophia? Let's say something tremendous. Go and find the flaws with that. Well, you know, the volumes of material just flows. Why do we seem to be more willing to aim for the flaws rather than seek the perfection or the beauty? I'm not sure of that. You know, I haven't really come to any kind of conclusion other than it's an observation that a lot of people that I live around do that. With an idea, they'll find the flaws with it rather than find the go-to characteristics, the things that are beneficial. If you have a chance to sit back and analyze anything or rethink it, often the benefit is when we're able to do both. We're able to look at ideas, parse them out for their benefit, and you know, examine our motivations, And if we're wise, look at what barriers there are, what complications, whether and then determine whether that is something that strikes our fancy, that we want to move forward with. It's not that clever in the big scheme of things, but it's something that I think would benefit me and a lot of the lodges that I attend if we were to begin doing it or be more mindful of this. But there's a buzzword for this century that I think is going to hold us in good stead in the future. Being more aware, you can see the pushback on woke. Woke culture. There's all of these beautiful little buzzwords that don't have much meaning after a while. You just throw them out there, but it escalates and it justifies escalation. And it's fascinating how the intelligentsia, I know that's a horrible word to say, the very brightest people just sort of shrink back into their work, go back to their, close the door and light another, here's a romantic image, light another candle in their laboratory and conduct their alchemical experiments. It still goes on, and wisely so. And forever in a day, we seem trapped by these notions of tribalism. We cannot be trusted. Oh my goodness! Unleash the furies! Just say think something like that. But what happens to all of those meetings of the mind, that symbiosis that's out there, where people aren't? How do we know? How do we know? Why am I assuming it's all bad? You see, that's crazy talk in this world. And that's just considered craziness. Why would you ever ask such questions? Just go along with the mainstream. Fit in. Go along with the crowd. We have had some brilliant writers writing philosophical novels, 1984 and Animal Farm, and if we sat down, it takes all the fun out of it to know the truth, doesn't it? I was taught that I should be suspicious and hate everything about this whole field of thinking, the writing of Karl Marx, and then I find out, a Jewish man who spent a lot of time doing his work in London, and he was a writer. And when you begin to actually read the material, it isn't what is sort of claimed by it. You know, it's not sort of supercharged or it's ideas. And ideas can be manipulated, like history, you know. Margaret Macmillan would want to tell us. Anyway, that aside, it's a wonder that you and I can just go on and be as content with life as we are. How do we? Is it magic or is it some kind of elixir? Is it the uniqueness of our Masonic gene pool? How do we do it? We do. It's not like, oh my goodness, it's that we do. And why not? Why not? Does it change life around us? Absolutely, it does. If that bunch of crazy old guys can sit back and relax and have a good time and do things that are really useful in their community, then they live in the same world that you and I do, and they breathe the same air. Why not me? Why not me? Why not us? They're just crazy old guys, you know, crazy old people, crazy old Freemasons. And I think I'm. You want to hear about crazy Freemasons? Here's a short shout out here, okay? To the people, the nations where you're tuning in. And I have deep respect for your countries, from from Greece, hello, and Japan, and always a pleasure to have you tuning in. For the very first time in all our years, we have listeners from South Africa. Welcome. Welcome. It's good to have you, truly, pulling up your bench and with your cup of coffee or tea or libation. United States, we seem to, you know, Masonry just flourished in the United States. This is just one of those ideas that was, you know, fit so well with the environment there, the intellectual environment. And listeners from Brazil, you've been with us for a very, very long time. My goodness, hello. And Russia, not as long as our Brazilian listeners, but just so, you know, where do we begin? Such magnificent history and complicated textured culture, just remarkable. It's a pleasure, yes. And Britain, well, that's like the grandfather sitting Masonic effects on its lap and saying, "No, surprise me." And we do. Masonry didn't become stagnant at all, though I'm inclined to think more as one of those people from up in the northern part of, you know, the Scots. And of course, Canada. Thank you for all your listeners. That's our shout-out list. It's changed. It's sustained. You know, people have been around and listening for a long time, but it brings the point. It makes the point that I'm trying clumsily to describe that we do have similarities. We do. Even if this is a very biased and a sample and it's not properly groomed and screened as statisticians would have us do, it's a statement that we've made these connections and the pivot point, I'll take blame for that. The pivot point is Masonic effects. But I think it has it speaks to bigger issues, bigger things going on, ideas. That whole business about us looking for the rightness and correctness and the things that we have in common with strangers, it's not idle. It's vital. It's very important. So here we start. A cup of coffee in hand. Mm-hmm. And some really decent company. You folks on the other end. We have the work of the poet Alfred Lord Tennyson, Morte d'Arthur, The Death of Arthur. I think you're going to enjoy that. And music that is just sublime. This gorgeous, gorgeous jazz. Anyway, let's tuck into it and see what happens. Where and when. This is starting the show. I don't know if I've ever started the show with material by Wynton Marsalis before. I've listened to quite a bit of his work. Tell me what you think. That'll just have to do. What a nice way to begin a program. Inspiration. There are places in the world where access to masonry is carefully weighed. Conversation have to be had, reasonable conclusions drawn, a sense of direction that heightens the senses. It's a given. Imagine knowing your participation represents a sense that this particular lodge values what they do to the extent that they are selective and you've been chosen for your potential. You are committed based on an understanding you want to be part of that particular lodge, that particular way of thinking. Wouldn't the Masonic environment be different if this was commonplace? It is more commonplace than we might suspect. Then why is it not more evident? More often we have this impression because the dialogue needed and necessary to support it isn't communicated. I don't think it's malevolent. I think it's something to do with either shyness or wanting to fit in. There is, I think, a mistaken sense that we can build effective lodges without being judgmental. Mm-hmm. It's not possible to go through a minute in a day without making judgments. What discerning men take into account is the basis of those judgments. Being judgmental is certainly a problem when it interferes with understanding and cohesiveness. I call that gotcha moments. The man that claims devil's advocacy is steering the conversation. It is the antithesis of shared inspiration when one man is distracted by his own bias. Rather than reasoning, he has stopped weighing the facts and instead injected opinion. It's as if you're saying, I'm too old to put new ideas into my brain. So that's the sum total. There, you have it. The rest is just me malarkey, as we say. You may have your own opinions, but you don't have your own facts. Nobody has a right to their own facts. Fact is, opinion is temporary and usually inconsistent with requirements. Inspiration is when a group are working on a similar wavelength. When men experience inspired men, they too are inspired. I think it's a hallmark of the craft. People. What does it take to inspire you or me? That's the rub, isn't it? You know within yourself it is unconscious attitude. No one wears the, hi, I'm inspired t-shirt. Inspiration is known as things unfold around us. Hindsight. In some groups that are open about being in touch, it happens. I think it's very, very difficult, and I don't know that it's possible to walk around aiming to inspire anybody that comes in contact with you. Doesn't that seem a little bit ragged? Or presumptuous? And why would we want to do that? Why would we feel that we are capable of inspiring everybody that comes? I can't read your mind. I can't read anybody's mind. But far from inspiration, I can I can read when somebody's hungry or somebody's afraid or troubled or sick. I can read that. I know the opinions. I can have lots of reasons to ignore, like learning, culturally I'm taught to ignore certain things. I'm taught to ignore poverty because of our system. Though it needs victims, and I'm taught to just ignore them. And hunger, I'm taught to ignore that. Little people growing up hungry, and by the way, it's easier to put that blame on little people's parents. It's much easier. It makes me feel very wholesome and cleansed in a way. I can walk away from it. I know this angers capitalism. I'm not talking about capitalists that are at the top of the food chain. I'm talking about the wannabes, the people that have figured out how to exploit further and can justify it. Keep the blinkers on and justify it for your own sake. The world goes on, and we have all. There's nothing wrong with. It's not a question of wealth. It's about redistribution, and that has to do with values. So will we always be nagged by those pesky happy people in Finland and Denmark and Sweden? How dare they just to be so blatantly content? And have such a high quality of life, or Liechtenstein. Oh, they're terrible because they're just wealthy. Hardly any of them, and they're just bloody wealthy. Well, it takes more than that. It takes people with ideas, shared ideas, working together. And can it happen? Yeah. Don't be too drawn away from the influence that you have, the values that you carry with you every day. And it may, and there's times when you will inevitably feel overwhelmed and ready to just go mainstream. It's so much easier. My goodness, at every turn, it's easier to just go along with the crowd. However, there's a lot of forces that have been influencing and interfering with, in a way, with the happiness of people. There is that sense. And remember, you'll be criticized for this. There is a sense that all is not what it appears, and we would be very wise to keep that in mind. However, doing that just makes us very, very hard to. We're not good sheep. we're not good subjects if we are asking questions, too many questions. The influence that you bear is in the small gestures as well as the mighty gestures. But can we influence outside of the powerful estates? I think that's the experiment that we've been running for a couple of hundred years. And myself, I would say, yeah, we can influence. And not in a bad way. Not in a bad way. Maybe there's a bit of juice left in the old boys yet, the old boys and girls. Now we're even questioning that. Where are we going intellectually if we're thinking that there's a gender? Are we the last bastion? We would keep Curie from getting her Nobel Prize, would we? Because she's a girl. Seems almost too absurd. Here. Mellow with this. Keith Jarrett, my goodness. Mr. Jarrett, Keith Jarrett, the Keith Jarrett Trio. And if he's listening in, I want to thank him for his music. I know your health has given you some challenges. You've given us, given the world a gift, and it's with us. And I can't imagine it will ever stop giving pleasure and joy to so many people. It's beautiful, beautiful music. Thank you. Today, our poet is that I've selected is Alfred Tennyson. Little Alfie Tennyson. He was made a peer after he became famous for what he does. But before, I just want to preempt this a little bit. I want to speak very briefly about why poetry and what could possibly be a connection between the poets and us. And I'm speaking generically. We're all of one mind. We're all incredibly enlightened. Remember that we came up, we were written up during a period when a lot of challenge was happening. A lot of things were being questioned. So the question I want to know is about Freemasonry, the importance of poetry to us in general. So it's interesting, I think, if we examine it, just a few short points here. In terms of symbolism, Freemasonry is rich in symbolism, and poetry is a means to convey complex ideas and moral lessons in an allegorical form. Gee, doesn't that seem close? It's like suggesting that a Masonic ritual is open poetry. And moral lessons. Poetry often carries moral and ethical messages aligning with the Masonic principles of virtue, integrity, and personal development. Virtue and integrity. Education. Masonic rituals and teachings often incorporate poetic elements to engage members in meaningful contemplation and self-improvement. Tradition. Freemasonry has a long history of incorporating poetry into its rituals and ceremonies, contributing to its cultural and traditional significance. Now, I can imagine some of listeners to Masonic Effects are more familiar with this than others. Inspiration. Poetry can inspire. Masons can inspire us to reflect on the deeper meanings of life and their Masonic journey and fostering personal growth and enlightenment. But overall, poetry in Freemasonry serves as a tool of conveying important lessons and fostering self-improvement and even preserving the traditions and symbolism of the fraternity. But that's not something enforced or imposed, I should say. It is what it is. Step with me to the work of little Alfie Tennyson. He is considered the leading Victorian poet in England, and his work is claimed for the structure and imagery. It's acclaimed for that. It helped the world to deal with doubts and difficulties of the time. For instance, traditional religious beliefs about human nature and destiny were increasingly being called into question by science and modern progress. Has that stopped? Do you still feel that tug? Oh my goodness, it's just too complicated. Keep it simple. Just spoon feed me. This is a fellow that was born in 1809. So he's after the period where the Masonry was beginning to be codified. And after the reactions, oh, this is boring. What the hell is this all we're going to do? That had happened just, about 20, 20, 30 years after the 1717 burst onto the scene. He came from a large family. He was 12 children. He was the fourth. And you can imagine, it was a struggle keeping things together. But his dad managed to give him a good literary education, especially because Alfred, we're told, was a precocious little kid. And, you know, think about this. This is a little guy, and he was already writing poetry in styles. And this is something that you and I do, I think, with Masonic thinking. We begin by picking up the style of some writer on Masonry that maybe it's Wilmshurst or Manly Hall or Pike or, you know, or Coyle or Mackay. You know, we pick up that style. Before it's claimed that he was writing in the style of Alexander Pope and Walter Scott and John Milton. This is not something that an idiot kid does. This is something that, you know, somebody's done something significant in their thinking is significant. So he began writing poetry. You know, one thing led to another. His dad became sick and began drinking. And, you know, what else do you do to cope? 1824, his dad began to break down. So things were not great. And sensitive little bugger, he was depressed by his home life, you know, and began collaborating and writing poetry. In 1826, he began producing and printing poetry with his brothers, Frederick and Charles. And in 1826, poems by two brothers. And he made more than half the contributions to the work, but nevertheless. And then Alfred and Charles joined Frederick at Trinity College in Cambridge. And Alfred made friends with a fellow named Arthur Hallam. Hallam was the talented son of a historian, William Hallam. And this was meeting of the minds. Remember when you were students, you just met these guys in the chemistry, just clicked. It was great. You can be outrageous together, or you can be outrageously deep together. By 1829, he was winning awards. He won the Chancellor's Gold Medal with a poem called Timbuktu. In 1830, he published poems and chiefly lyrical, the two poems, and Tennyson and Hallam went to Spain to help with the unsuccessful revolution against Ferdinand VII. Mm-hmm. They were making commitments, yeah. Hallam had become attached to Tennyson's sister, Emily, but was forbidden by her father to correspond with her for a year. And then that nonsense. But in 1831, Tennyson's dad died, and his misery was increased by his father's discovery of his grandfather's discovery of his father's debts. So he left Cambridge without taking a degree. And his grandfather made financial arrangements for the family. And that same year, Hallam published a eulogistic article on poems called Chiefly Lyrical in the Englishman's Magazine. And then he went to Somersby in 1832 and as the accepted suitor of Emily. Happiness. So 1832, he published quite a bit. Tennyson published another volume of his poems entitled The Lotus Eaters. You probably heard that term. The Palace of Art and the Lady of Shalott. Mm-hmm. What fan of poetry hasn't, eh? British poetry, English poetry. And then there was a satirical epigram on the critic Christopher North. And that was the pseudonym of a Scottish writer, John Wilson, who had attacked the poems, Chiefly Lyrical, in Blackwood's Magazine. And Tennyson sadly prompted a scathing attack in his new volume. You know, don't pick the scab. You know, they're going to come in and get you. And he became upset. He's sensitive, you know, became upset. And he continued. So he started to revise his own poems. You know, sort of, I can think it might have been the effect of, you know, political correctness at an early point. Things are going along. Hallam was dating his sister, and then he went to Vienna, and he died. Hallam died, and this shocked Tennyson, and became depressed. And three of his brothers, Edward and Charles and Septimus, suffering from mental illness, and the bad reception of his own work added to the gloom. So this is the guy. Now, if that isn't a good time, isn't that just, you know, isn't that enough to set your mind a tingle that, you know, what have we done here? We're talking about work here that touches on many intellectual issues of the Victorian era. So, Morte d'Arthur. This is what we call it. Today we call it the passing of Arthur, the king. It's one of the poet's most famous works. It was completed in 1842. And this is, Thomas Malory wrote an epic, La Morte d'Arthur, in 1485. And in book 21 of that work, Arthur had been fatally wounded by his friend Mordred. And all of the knights, including Sir Bedivere, have died. And only Sir Lucan remains to help move Arthur. And other influences included Shakespeare's Hamlet, with its emphasis on, you know, despair, and Homer's Odyssey. Tennyson then came up with the idea of an Arthurian epic in the 1830s, in his circle of Cambridge friends, and that included Hallam. And these young guys looked to literature to compensate for the lack of spiritual values that they observed in their own time. I think that's happening today. And he began to study Malory's work. And then, boom, the poem started to work on Morte by the end of the year. And this was something that was very personal and important to him. And so it's framed in another poem. There's another poem that frames this one. Smart guys, riffing, as you would say, riffing on the thinking. I think absolutely, yeah, no question about it. At least in my mind. So let's see what we can find here. La Morte if you just type the title, you'll get some other material, because the title Morte, the passing of Arthur, was used in different frames here. So all a day long, the noise of battle rolled among the mountains by the winter sea, until King Arthur's table, man by man, had fallen in Lyonnais about their lord. King Arthur then, because his wound was deep, the bold Bedivere uplifted him, and Sir Bedivere, the last of all his knights, and bore him to a chapel near the field. A broken chancel with a broken cross that stood in a dark strait of barren land. And on one side lay the ocean, and on one lay a great water, and the moon was full. And then spake King Arthur to Sir Bedivere. The sequel of today on soldiers, all the goodliness, fellowship of famous knights, whereof this world holds record, such as sleep, they sleep, the men I loved. I think that we shall nevermore, at any future time, delight our souls with talk of knightly deeds. Walking about the gardens and halls of Camelot, as in the days that were, I perish by this people which I made. Though Merlin swore that I should come again to rule once more, but let that will be what be will be. I am so deeply smitten through the helm that without help I cannot last till morn. Though therefore take my brand, Excalibur. What was my pride? For thou rememberest how in those old days, one summer noon, an arm rose up from the bosom of the lake, clothed in white smits and mystic and wonderful and holding the sword. And how I rode across and took it and have worn it like a king. Wheresoever I am sung or told in aftertime, this also shall be known. For now delay not, take Excalibur and fling him far into the middle mere. Watch what thou seest. Lightly bring me the word. So said he, and the barge with oar and sail moved from the brink, like some full-breasted swan that, flirting a wild carol ere her death, ruffles her pure gold plume and takes the flood with swarthy webs. Long stood Sir Bedivere, revolving many memories, till the hull looked one black dot against the verge of dawn, and on the mirror, the wailing just died away. That's a heavily truncated version of this poem. Nice poem. You might like some of his other work. Charge of the Light Brigade, Claribel, Crossing the Bar, The Eagle, Break, 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 you know. Bill Evans. This is homage to my younger brother, Gary. It's called Gary's Theme. Well, our history lesson, looking at what was going on and the influence of that stuff happening in Britain on a major trading hub in Holland, in Amsterdam. And we've been following a lot of the detail bless their little hearts, and the secretaries and scribes of Lamy Lodge gave us so much context that really excited historians like Margaret C. Jacob. And we're just coming up to the end. We've worked through Living the Enlightenment. All those challenges and ideas, but not generally. We were looking at what was happening with Enlightenment, and it was more in one area of Enlightenment, but we were talking about Britain, but also in in Italy, about, I think, three or four different areas, Germany, you know, the principalities there, different areas where Enlightenment had a broader, different depth and context. This is, I think there's parallels myself, I find, and as I'm reading through, I'm trying to bring them up clumsily and awkwardly to your attention. We're looking around at the period of 1787. So what's in the air? Revolution, huh? Revolution is in the air. What's happened in America, that upstart, you know, facing down the imperial might of Britain? And what was percolating in the background? France, the Republicans were surging forward, demanding accountability. And different histories, of course. And here we look at the mainland, hey? And a conclusion. So bear with the conclusions here that, or the assumptions here, because I think it makes for an interesting read. The important turning point of the confrontation between patriots and Orangists, yes, that William of Orange group, was 1787. Both sides were armed and civil disturbances occurred in nearly every town or city of any importance. By the summer of that year, it was clear that the stadtholder, sort of the government, had lost control over the republic. And yet it was also clear that support for the patriots was neither firm enough nor unified enough to ensure their ability to seize control of the institutions of local and national government. Bureaucracy, eh? You're rebels, you need bureaucracy to stabilize your gains. In so many cities, the old oligarchy remains strong, as it would. At the same time, patriotic rhetoric was becoming increasingly democratic. The patriots claimed to speak for the people. The specter of the revolution of 1747 haunted these proceedings. And on that occasion, the little people of Amsterdam, in quotes, led by Van Gimnig and Roussette de Missy, had, for a brief time, refused to be governed. In 1787, there were demands for a national assembly with the purpose of dismantling the Estates General, which was, in any event, hopelessly deadlocked. So similar are many of the moves made by the patriots to what eventually unfolded in Paris in 1789. That's kind of eerie, that some historians have imagined the Republic in 1787 as a rehearsal for the French Revolution. It is better to see both phenomena as part of a larger movement for reform and then revolution that erupted for different and yet similar reasons. In the late 1780s in the Low Countries in France, in The Hague in 1787, as opposed to Versailles in 1791. The stadtholder had a trump card. In the autumn of 1787, the Prussian army, allies of the stadtholder, William V, and the British, invaded the Republic, and before long, even Amsterdam surrendered. And as one patriot put it, the English endeavor to enslave everyone and keep themselves free. Thus began years of repression, of officially sponsored violence against the patriots, many of whom now fled south to Brussels and Paris. Yet the traffic was not all one way. A new member from Brussels is initiated in the Amsterdam Lodge in 1794. The minutes of Le Bien Ami are eerie in their silence for much of 1787. And when they resume in 1788, membership had fallen from the high of 81 in 1785 to 43 and eventually to 22 in 1792. The master urges his brothers to recommence our work with new zeal after an extraordinary quiet, not caused by the sound of the hammer of discord striking in our temple, but by the unfortunate circumstance of the times outside. Private, enlightened sociability always possessed the capability to work inward towards self-knowledge and improvement. The formula was classical and stoic in origin, and its adherents believed that private virtue cultivated in society would serve the state. Now the brothers are urged to renounce oneself of it and of necessity to control one's temper. Or they are reminded about the goal of our order being to make a Freemason humane, reasonable, and virtuous. Times are hard as winter sets in. They become even harder. And in the winter of 1788-89 was one of the worst on record throughout Western Europe. The orator gave a moving speech about the destitutions of the present incessant severe winter and recommended liberal compassion for his fellow brothers and equal human beings. The patriot ideology of equality gave added meaning to the hardship of that winter, which would be seen in retrospect to have boded so ill for the kings of Europe. With hardship, the lodge's debt only mounted. And still, Lew Donaldson, Autumn Nocturne. Am I losing the plot here, gentlemen, ladies? Am I? I don't, you know, I hear, it's like things seem to cycle. And we're hearing, I don't think I could say that there's any less tension in the world, but we're aware of it. And I don't think we have quite a portion of people amongst us that are vulnerable and fragile. They're not like us. And we can hate that. Yes, we can be angry, but it doesn't help. It doesn't help. We have these waves of illness that are around us, and we're coming to terms with it. The new science, that's just an old pathetic drunk, and that kid is just passed out on the street. That's disgusting. Well, we're finding that these are diseases that we're dealing with. These are symptoms, and enlightened people are doing something about this. We're even doing something about poverty by looking at the data. But that confronts ideology, and that's, my goodness, like a repeat of the impact of enlightenment, the new challenge to status quo. And that did not go well, did it, for a lot of people? That was a dogfight, because power does not give it away. You know, it doesn't give it away. And even now we hear some really far-fetched stories about, you know, we call them now conspiracies. Back then we were looking at, we called them, you know, superstitions. Where does that situate you and me? It puts us clearly, like if you're inclined, you know, it puts us in a good category. Do your reading, follow the Follow truth. Keep use the facts. They won't let you down. And overall, it's sort of like the stock market. Eventually, it comes back. It floats back. So, the most satisfying, my goodness, I think, for a lot of people is just opinion. I'm angry about thus and such, and therefore I'm angry about all of that, or anybody that looks like that. So here we have the, what do we have? Do we call it an advantage for being mature or having insight? Nah, nobody told us insight would be pretty, or that self-development would be just a joke. Slap a happy face sticker on me and I'm just wonderful. No, nothing like that. It's serious. Life is serious. And in between, we enjoy it. People like you and I, we make the best of it and we are good company and we are lively conversationalists and we read and we have an interest and we connect. Those interests connect us. And that's the joie de vivre, eh? As a shout out to this lovely man, Joseph. He's just lovely. He's over in Prague again. And why anybody would leave Prague, I don't know, but that's me. And they're celebrating 100-year anniversary of their Grand Lodge. Spectacular. But he will bring back, he's an interesting man, and he will bring back tales of that journey that frankly will amaze and should. For places like where I am, and I hope that in some small way we contribute to your liking, the depth. You just see another dimension of masonry through this lens we call Masonic Effects. Again, we have a week ahead of us. We're coming up to Thanksgiving, and that's a bit. Like we've just came through in my country a day of truth and reconciliation. We're looking at the failed genocide of First Nations, and the work. It goes on and on. Some of these schools were closed in 1996. Like, and I remember the outrage. I ran into a professor's office in the 70s. Outrage! This can't be going on. It's Canada, you know, a land of rights and freedoms. And what did he say? Yes, it is. And I've done my part to contribute to the betterment of, in my own way. And a lot of people have. Coming to terms with the past is not pretty. But we have Germany to the way that they've grown and progressed as we expect the wonderful old culture to deal with, help. You know, the world and themselves heal and deal with a very tragic period in their history. We have, and we have the support of a lot of people wanting reconciliation. The only way is to deal with the truth. So that's where I'm coming from. And it's sad, but it's also inspiring to see, hear some, it's like listening to, I still have the vivid memory, but I want to, we'll tie you up with that right now. You don't deserve that. I'll look for you again in a week's time. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And if you get the exquisite, if you're really, you know, that frisson, then try to experience it. And to doing it anonymously and check out the feeling. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing. And if you're doing a kindness, be mindful and treat yourself well. See you soon. Thanks for your patience.